Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Joe Martucci here, and this podcast is proudly sponsored by Weather Call Services. Don't be caught off guard by severe weather. Choose Weather Call.
Hello once again, everybody. I'm meteorologist Sean Sublitz, and welcome to Across the Sky. It's our national Lee Enterprises weather podcast. Lee Enterprises has digital and print news operations in more than 70 locations across the country, including in my home base here in Richmond, Virginia. I'm joined by meteorologist Matt Hollander in Chicago this week, Kirsten Lang and Joe Martucci both out of the office. Matt, we are getting into spring now, which means thunderstorm season. You've been a meteorologist for a long time. Do you have any cool lightning stories or dangerous lightning stories?
Yeah, one from personal experience. Now, it wasn't in the spring, it was in the summer when I was visiting my grandmother in Colorado, Silverthorne, Colorado, but we were out biking. That's a big thing. Oftentimes we would go to Colorado and do some skiing, but if you go to Colorado in the summer, biking is the new number one activity. So we were doing some biking and we were near a lake, Lake Dillon. It's actually Silverthorne and Dillon, Colorado, right next to each other. So Lake Dillon, and there's a dam on Lake Dillon. And I could see, now this was back when I was in middle school, so I was not a trained meteorologist yet, but I was interested in weather. And I could see the dark clouds and the lightning in the distance. And I knew we needed to finish up this bike ride, especially since we're kind of in an elevated place on this dam above where the water is. We're kind of high and isolated. I'm like, we need to finish up this bike ride and head in. But we're stuck. We got to get across the dam in order to get to a building to take shelter in. So my grandmother and I are ahead, and my brother and mom are lagging behind a little bit. I'm just focused on getting across the dam. I get to cross the dam, look back, and I don't see my mom and brother right away because they were around a bend. There's like kind of a rock wall and you couldn't see it. I was like, where are they? About 5 minutes later, they showed up with wide-eyed looks, this kind of and pale complexion, like this kind of look of terror. And I was like, what happened? And I was a little bit worried because there had just been a very loud clap of thunder. And so I thought maybe it was just the thunder that scared them. But it turns out they were so close to where this lightning had struck. We were farther ahead. And they were so close to it, they could feel it. It wasn't just hearing the thunder. They actually felt the thunder. They said it felt like they were wearing helmets, but it felt like somebody had taken a hammer and slammed a hammer on the top of their helmets. Their heads actually went down. Now, we think it was just the sound wave. They weren't physically hurt, but they felt, we think, the reverberation from the thunder because they were so close. So that was a very close call and one that kind of shook all of us. It's like, wow, that was too close. That was really too close. So that's the lightning story that really stands out for me. A close call. I'm glad my mom and brother fortunately weren't seriously hurt, but they almost did. Just it gives you an idea of the power of lightning where you're talking about what it can do even if you're not directly hit.
And it's important to know when lightning is possible. I mean, back when we were in graduate school, so this is 30 years or so ago, a group of us went down to the Outer Banks and we wanted to go golfing one day. And we knew thunderstorms in the forecast. This is the early 90s, of course, so there's no weather apps. And we get out to like by the 5th, 6th fairway. So we're out there and the clouds are gathering. We start to hear distant thunder, right? We're like, well, maybe we can finish this round. Maybe we can finish this hole. Because, you know, we're young and stubborn and dudes. So we get out, I guess it was a 6th or 7th fairway. My one friend gets up to get to his second shot on the fairway. He's standing there addressing the ball, and all of a sudden he just drops the club and backs away. And we said, what's wrong? He's like, I started to feel warm. I'm like, all right, that's it, we're out of here. And we just got on that golf cart and hightailed it back to the clubhouse. And before we got to the clubhouse, it just opened up rain on us. Nobody got struck by lightning, but it was one of those things like, can you imagine if something had gone wrong and the headlines the next day were like three meteorologists killed in lightning on golf course, that'd have been just, oh my heaven. So anyway, with all of that, it is thunderstorm season. It's lightning season. So we wanted to bring back our colleague, Chris Vigasky, who for a long time was with Visala Instrumentation, who runs one of the world's largest lightning detection networks. Chris has since moved to Wisconsin to develop their MesoNet, which is a high-resolution network of weather sensors across the state that ultimately will better help them understand weather and climate on very small scale. So with that, let's get right to our conversation with Chris Vigasky.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chris, thanks for joining us again. Your second appearance here on the Across the Sky podcast. Good to have you with us again, sir.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Sean. It's always good to be here. We got to get a good theme song or something. Maybe we can, you know, get ChatGPT to write something along the lines of Across the Universe.
And give me that German name for what a lightning expert is called. I just love that.
Oh, the Swedish name, the Blitz Experten.
Oh, I thought it was German. Excuse me.
Yep, Swedish. The Blixtexperten.
That's a good one. That's a good one. So on that, right, just a month or two ago, you had a paper come out in the bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. And I love it when we title these things in a very straightforward way. And the title of it was called, How Much Lightning Actually Strikes the United States? Straight to the point. So tell me what the answer is. So we know there's a lot of lightning that strikes Florida. That one's kind of obvious. But what kind of things did we learn going back through the data?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question to ask because, you know, if you look at different resources, and the National Severe Storms Lab's website says lightning strikes 25 million times a year. The Centers for Disease Control says lightning strikes 40 million times per year. That's a huge difference. That's 15 million lightning strikes. So, you know, what's one or two between friends? That's one thing. But, you know, 1 or 2 million between friends, that's, you know, a big discrepancy. So we couldn't figure out where those numbers came from. So we wanted to really pin that down. So we went back and we looked through, you know, a few years of National Lightning Detection Network data at flashes, strokes, and then a new thing called ground strike points. So when you look outside, you see lightning flickering. That whole flickering process is the lightning flash. Each of those flickers is a stroke. But those strokes can hit different points on the ground, and that's where we get these ground strike points. So we wanted to answer that for, you know, all of the different categories of lightning. So for flashes, strokes, and ground strike points, how much of each are detected every year? And the numbers are actually pretty close. About 23.5 to 24 million flashes per year, which is really close to what the National Severe Storms Lab says. It's about 56 million strokes, so the individual flickers in each of those flashes, and then they hit about 38 million ground strike points. So it's pretty close to what the Centers for Disease Control says. So wherever those numbers came from, they were pretty close, but now we've got to actually pin down, and it's actually now out there in the literature, so it can be properly cited and properly referenced.
Yeah, that's the good thing. Have one point of reference, because I think that takes a lot of, you know, expert communication as well. Just the difference between a flash, a stroke, a ground strike, and all of that kind of stuff. You know, so many times we see, oh, is it in cloud strike or is it cloud to cloud strike? When I see this on my lightning detection network, did it actually hit the ground or was it just in the cloud? All these questions that I still think don't get the attention or don't have the answers readily to people that are consuming lightning information.
Yeah, I mean, that's always the, you know, the big concern. And, you know, we put that in the paper as well. It said there's still confusion about what a lightning strike is. Is it in cloud lightning? Is it only cloud to ground lightning? So, you know, we are definitive here that lightning strike is those ground strike points, because that's where the ground is being actually struck, but it's made up of the flashes and the strokes to get to those ground strike points.
Did we find anything new or surprising in the data in terms of like distribution of lightning, spatial or time or anything like that? Or was that pretty much kind of the same?
Well, we've clarified it. So, yeah, you still see most of the lightning occurring along the Gulf Coast and the central and southern plains, where you get severe thunderstorms. You get the, you know, the pop-up and, you know, the sea breeze, land breeze interaction and all of that going on in the summertime. So we still see all of that. Where we do the really good clarification is these ground strike points. Because they can hit the ground tens of meters, so, you know, like 30 feet away from each other. They can hit the ground hundreds of meters, so 300 feet away. Or they can hit the ground 6 miles away from each other. And that's what's really important. Because if you're looking for, you know, preparing for lightning strikes to a building, or if you're preparing for forest fires, wildfires, being able to discriminate where those ground strike points are and where on the planet those ground strike points are most frequent, then you can put into place better lightning protection, or you can put into place better, you know, preventative plans, so that if lightning strikes, you can get first responders out more quickly to respond to fires or things like that.
And Chris, I want to ask about the National Lightning Detection Network, because it's something that often gets referenced, but I really don't know a whole lot about it. And it seems like a lot of people don't. So who is operating that? Is it government funded? Is it private companies that are contributing to it? How many sites are there? And what kind of maintenance is needed to maintain this National Lightning Detection Network? So can you just tell us more about it in general?
Yeah, so in the National Lightning Detection Network has been detecting lightning since the 1980s. It started as kind of a research project out of some universities, including SUNY Albany and the University of Arizona. And their goal was to improve awareness of lightning strikes to power distribution, so power outages and things like that, and also for wildfires. Over the years, from the mid-1980s into the 1990s, the network expanded. It became a part of a company called Global Atmospherics, which was then bought by Vaisala in the early 2000s. And Vaisala now owns and operates the National Lightning Detection Network. The NLDN is critically important to so many industries. You know, we talked about fire weather, we talked about energy distribution, now wind energy, and knowing our turbines getting struck. It's used by the National Weather Service on a daily basis to know where thunderstorms are, to monitor for intensifying thunderstorms, public safety, all sorts of different applications. You know, I've been stuck on an airplane for 3 hours waiting for thunderstorms to clear because of the NLDN data showing that every 2 or 3 minutes, a new in-cloud lightning flash was occurring over Orlando Airport. And I'm begging Vaisala, hey, just shut off the network for a few minutes so that I can, you know, take off. So there's a lot of things that, you know, there are a lot of industries that really rely on this lightning data. So it has to be good. It has to be up. So Vaisala works extremely hard to keep a better than 99.95, and they're approaching 99.99% uptime with the National Lightning Detection Network. And that's a big challenge, because there's about 120 of these lightning detection antennas that are placed all around the United States. So you've got to make sure that they're all operating, they're all communicating. And there's a 24/7 operation center in Boulder, Colorado, that is just watching the labels for each of those stations 24/7 to make sure that they're always green. And if they're red, they know what they need to do to get out there to go and do a repair or call the phone company and say, hey, you got to get the, you know, the internet back running so that this thing can communicate with us, because, you know, we're relying on this for, you know, all of these different industries. So, there's a big group of people that are always working to make sure that the lightning detection network is running and providing that high quality data.
Now, it is interesting to me that for radar, that is operated by the government. The network of those NEXRAD Doppler radars is run by NOAA, and they completely operate it. So it's interesting to me that the National Lightning Detection Network is not also operated by NOAA. Do you know the reasoning why NOAA kind of lets a private company handle lightning detection? Meanwhile, the government is very involved in tracking thunderstorms with radar, but it's kind of handing the lightning part of it off to a private company. Do you know the reasoning behind that?
It kind of goes back to history. So we are right now just starting to look at radar next. So what's going to be the next radar network that is put in place across the United States? Is it going to be phased array? Are we going to continue with the radars that we've currently got and do some modifications or things like that? But before what we've got now, which is known as the Weather Service Radar 88 Doppler, 88 means 1988. Before that was the WSR 74C, which is the 74 meant 1974. And even before that was the WSR 57. So that was 1957. So the government has been in the radar business for almost 70 years now. Lightning detection really got going in the 1980s with the National Lightning Detection Network, which was started at a university and then became a private company. So rather than build out their own entire network for themselves, the Weather Service turned to the National Lightning Detection Network to be kind of the first private data buy that the government was using. And we're starting to hear more and more about these private data buys with satellite data and different things like that. So it's really kind of a historical thing. 70 years of radar history with NOAA and the Weather Service, 50 years or 40 years now of lightning detection, but it was, you know, generated by a private company initially, so it's just continued on that way.
Yes, and somebody already had it going. No reason to start over. If they've got something that was already being built up, why not just continue to use it and expand on it? So that's good to know. And now I want to get to a listener question we got, and that's kind of what triggered this episode in the first place. We need to get Chris back on and answer this for us, because we couldn't quite answer it for him. And it comes to the accuracy of the lightning detection network. So this question came in from Joshua Williams in Skytook, Oklahoma. And it's a two-part question, because he's wanting to know something specific, but then also just kind of more in general about the accuracy of the lightning detection network. So the first part of the question is, does a large body of water, such as a lake or ocean, have any effect on the geolocated accuracy of the lightning detection network? And then the follow-up is, what are some of the other things that could cause the lightning detection network to misclassify or mislocate a strike? So kind of coming into the accuracy, what impacts the accuracy of the National Lightning Detection Network?
Yeah, and so one of the really unique things about the National Lightning Detection Network is you only need two sensors to be able to detect and locate lightning. And that's because of the technology that goes into them. So each of those NLDN antennas is a combination of magnetic direction finding and time of arrival. So magnetic direction finding is basically looking for what direction did the lightning wave come from, so it points in that direction. So you're going to have two stations that point at a single place and say, okay, that's where the lightning came from. We get then better accuracy of, all right, I'm pointing towards, you know, Skyatook. With time of arrival, we get very precise measurements down to the nanosecond of when did that lightning wave get to the antennas. And then we can really precisely locate exactly where that happened. And so the location accuracy of National Lightning Detection Network now is 100 meters or better. So better than a football field. So it's extremely precise. because of these two different technologies. Now, you know, bodies of water really don't have that much of an impact, except in some really unique cases, which we'll get to. What really impacts, you know, some accuracy over bodies of water is if it's frozen. So ice acts like a brick wall for lightning waves. The lightning waves do not propagate well across ice. So it's difficult to detect lightning across Greenland or across the Arctic, you know, Siberia in the wintertime, just because ice acts as a blocker for those lightning waves. So what really can impact the accuracy of the lightning detection network will be the intensity of the lightning. How strong is it? How much electricity is coming out of it? Because if it's weaker, then the waves don't travel as far to the sensors that are distributed across the country. And so the more sensors that can detect it, the more accurate we can make those measurements, because we have more things that are pointing, saying that's where it was. We have more calculations we can do with the time of arrival, and so we can get a lot more precise. So the intensity is a big thing. The distribution or the geometry of the network is something that's important. If you put a whole lot of sensors in Florida, and you put a whole lot of sensors in Chicago, and you put a whole lot of sensors in Washington, D.C., and you have like three sensors in southwestern United States because there's not as many people there, your calculations are going to be less accurate because you're relying so much on things that are further away, or they're all clustered in one location. And because of that, you get a location that's completely incorrect. So having a uniform distribution where sensors are evenly distributed across the country, that's another way that you get more accuracy. So I wouldn't worry too much about, you know, body of water disrupting things or anything like that, but it's really relying on the technology. So time of arrival, magnetic direction finding, the distribution of the lightning sensors, and then the intensity of the lightning. Now, no lightning network is going to be 100% perfect 100% of the time. There's always going to be weird things that happen. There's things called narrow bipolar events where it's a really small flash overall in a cloud, but it's extremely powerful. And a lot of networks will say, oh, that was cloud-to-ground lightning because it packed 300,000 amps. But it was really just something that was in the cloud. And then you'll have cloud-to-ground events that are 1,000 amps. And they'll say, well, that was really weak. That must have been a cloud flash. So no network is going to be 100% accurate 100% of the time. But networks are getting really, really good at correctly locating, classifying, and identifying the lightning now.
Hey, Chris, before we go to break, a couple quick follow-ups on that. First of all, and I know you can't speak for every single weather app that's out there, but to your knowledge, when people have a weather app, a stock weather app, and there is lightning detection on it, does that all lightning, or is that typically cloud to ground?
So that will generally be cloud to ground flashes. So when you think of the numbers that we were talking about from the BAMS article, flashes, strokes, ground strike points, flashes is the smallest number, strokes is the biggest number. So it's generally cloud to ground flashes that are included in the weather apps.
Got it. And to what extent does ice slow down these waves? Because I thought these were radio waves. And look, this is not my forte at all, but is there any way to explain how ice is going to slow down propagating radio waves? Because that's what I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around.
Yeah. No, it's weird to think about. You're like, what? How does that happen? So there are two different types of waves that we're measuring when we're detecting lightning. One is the ground wave, and then one is the wave that bounces between the Earth and the ionosphere. So the ionosphere, really high up in the atmosphere, it's full of electrons, and it helps move these lightning waves across the Earth, which allows us to detect lightning up to 10,000 kilometers away. So a sensor in the United States could detect something in Australia. Now, ice just has a very low propagation factor. So dry ground, wet ground, water, ice, Rocky Mountains, they're each of these different types of land use, or each of these different types of land that we have across the planet, each has a different ability to allow ground waves to propagate and to allow those waves to bounce back and forth. So ice is just one of those things that just doesn't propagate really well. I'm not sure of all the science and physics behind it. I rely on somebody that's a lot smarter than me to go through and come up with the ways of detecting these, and then I figure out how do we use these detections. But ice is just one of those things that doesn't do well at allowing those lightning waves to propagate across them.
Fair enough. We have so many different, you know, surface features, and they all act differently with different, you know, electromagnetic waves and the like. So that's still very, very good to know. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back, talk with Chris more about things that you do know, things that you might not know, and things that people are trying to sell you regarding lightning when we continue on the Across the Sky podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by WeatherCall Services. Don't be caught off guard by severe weather. Choose WeatherCall. Receive precise, location-specific alerts via phone, text, or email. With over a decade of experience, WeatherCall delivers pinpoint accuracy for your exact address, ensuring no surprises. Take charge and stay prepared when ominous skies loom. Explore the WeatherCall difference today. Visit weathercallservices.com/lee-enterprises and safeguard yourself, your business, or any school that matters to you. That's weathercallservices.com/lee-enterprises. You can also find the link in our show notes.
And we are back with Chris Bogaski, our favorite lightning expert here on the Across the Sky podcast. You know, Chris, there are still a lot of myths that are out there about lightning. I think just within the last year, I saw somebody post another picture online. They're giggling and they're smiling as their hair is standing on end, not knowing that you've got an electric field that's just a Bremen right now. And that's not something you ought to be happy about. What other kinds of myths do you still get a lot of out there?
Yeah, and then, you know, that's an important thing. I've seen a few videos and I've had people reach out to me as well saying, you know, I was at Death Valley. I stuck my finger out to point at something. I've heard a buzzing. Or if your hair is standing on end, I've seen people hiking in Colorado with that, or I saw, you know, somebody in a desert in China where that happened. If you hear buzzing when you point your finger, if your hair is standing on end, Sean, it may not work for you so much to just point your finger out and listen for the buzzing. There's a strong electric field there and it's ready to trigger. So, you know, get into a lightning safe place, so a fully enclosed metal vehicle, a substantial building, something like that. The big one that I keep hearing, if I'm holding my cell phone, I'm going to get struck. Lightning doesn't care. If I'm holding my golf club, I'm going to hold up the one iron because not even God can hit a one iron. you know, holding a golf club, holding a fishing pole, holding something metal, it's not going to attract lightning to you. Lightning is coming out of the sky at 200,000 miles per hour. It doesn't care what it's coming down into. It's just looking for, you know, electric charge to be coming up. The shoes that you're wearing aren't necessarily going to protect you. Don't go out there and put on rubber-soled shoes thinking you'll be safe. You know, flip-flops, you know, golf spikes, football spikes, whatever. The clothes you wear, what you're holding, anything like that, that's not going to protect you or attract lightning to you. So that's a big one that we continue to see. Two other ones that I am always harping on. Lightning cannot be predicted and lightning cannot be prevented. So you're not going to be able to predict when and where lightning is going to strike, and you're not going to be able to prevent lightning from striking. The thunderstorm cloud is, you know, at least 5 miles by 5 miles by 5 miles. So let's call it that for easy math. You know, that's 125 cubic miles of electric charge. Putting something on a pole on top of a building that's, you know, the big around is a golf ball, big around is a baseball, that's not going to dissipate that charge. I could go through and get a whiteboard out here, start scribbling a bunch of math or anything like that. But we don't have to. You've got a baseball-sized thing versus 125 cubic miles of electric charge. It's not going to prevent lightning from happening. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but having said that, taller things are more susceptible, right, to lightning strikes. I mean, I've, you know, heard so many times that the Empire State Building gets struck so many times a year, but the height of an object certainly increases its chances. That's correct, isn't it?
That is correct. So when you think about what's more likely to get struck, it's isolated, it's tall, and it's pointy. Isolated because it's more likely just to, if it's the one thing that's out there, it's more likely to get struck. Tall, it's closer to the clouds, closer to the electric field. And pointy, it helps to really enhance that electric field. So if it's isolated, tall, and pointy, stay away from it during a thunderstorm. So that could be just a tall pine tree. It could be a tall building, especially one that's got a pointy top on it, a wind turbine, anything like that. But just because it's isolated, tall, and pointy doesn't mean that's going to be the object that gets struck. We've seen time and time again, the parking lot gets struck next to the light post, or the ground gets struck next to the building, or things like that. So these are just, you know, things that make lightning strikes more favorable. It doesn't mean it's going to always strike there. So isolated, tall, and pointy, definitely avoid. But anytime there's thunder, anytime there's lightning in the area, you need to be in a lightning safe place.
A couple more questions before I turn it back over to Matt. And this is, you know, regarding safety. You know, with lightning, if there's a ground strike somewhere, and obviously it depends on the strength of the strike, but, you know, you don't have to be right next to the thing to be impacted. You know, there is no hard and fast, like, oh, X amount of yards away and you're safe. But is there, you know, a first approximation that says, well, you know, I'm half a mile away, that's probably okay. Or I'm 100 yards away, that's probably okay. Or like, no, there's still so much charge going through even at X amount of distance. Is there any kind of ballpark idea that people can kind of take with them?
Yeah, we talked about that a lot in calls that the National Lightning Safety Council has. And so I'm a member of the National Lightning Safety Council, and we talk monthly about, you know, what we're working on to, you know, improve awareness or what we can do to keep people safe from lightning. And, you know, if you look at a golf course green that's been struck by lightning, usually hits the flagpole. It's tall, isolated, and pointy. And then you'll see the ground current. So you'll see the fractal pattern across the green. It looks really cool, but also kind of tells us how far that current has traveled. And, you know, that can be on the order of 20, 30, 100 feet. But if there's something in the ground, you know, electric wiring, the sprinkler system, you know, some sort of metal object, it can then extend even further, you know, 50 yards, 100 yards, a half a mile. So there really isn't a, this is the distance, you know, sort of thing. And as you get further and further away, if I'm a half mile away, I know I'm safe. So that's why we always tell people there's no safe place outside during a thunderstorm when thunder roars go indoors. Because most people who are struck are not directly hit by lightning. They're hit by that ground current. So lightning strikes nearby, the electricity comes up their leg, goes through their body, and goes down their other leg. So it's, you know, it's something that anytime there's thunder around, you got to be inside.
One more thing before I give it to you, Matt. Chris, remind people why a car is safe. It's not because it's the rubber tires.
It is not because of the rubber tires. A car is safe because an airplane is safe because there's a metal shell around you. And we've been seeing a lot of videos lately of planes getting struck by lightning. Planes are made to handle that. Cars are made to handle that. When lightning strikes a car, strikes a plane, the electricity travels through the metal shell and then jumps to the ground. And because you're surrounded by that metal shell, you're protected. So it's not the rubber tires, it's the metal shell. And that's why you need to be in a fully enclosed metal vehicle. So if you're in a convertible with a rag top, if you're in a golf cart, if you're on an ATV, anything like that, that's not going to protect you because it's got to be fully surrounding you with that metal shell.
And Chris, coming back to buildings and lightning, so we hit on that you can't prevent your building from being hit. That it's going to happen. You're going to get hit. But what about lightning rods? What do lightning rods actually do? Because there are certainly tall buildings that install lightning rods. And then I think the question that people then follow up is, well, should I put a lightning rod on my house? Should I invest in that? So can you talk a little bit about lightning rods and what they do?
Yes. So lightning rods act to take the electricity from lightning and take it to the ground. So a lightning rod is a metal rod that's connected usually to a long copper wire or some other form of metal to the ground where the electricity then dissipates in the ground. So all the lightning rod is doing, it's just a passive metal pole to take that electricity from the top of the building to the earth. It's not going to attract lightning. People like to say, oh, it's going to attract lightning. Well, if it was going to attract lightning, then you'd be able to do lightning prevention, because that's what these lightning prevention companies say, is we're sending out these electric pulses to, you know, dissipate the electricity. That doesn't happen. So lightning rods are only there to be passive so that if lightning strikes it, it takes that electricity to the ground. If you don't have a lightning rod, the electricity will travel through the pipes and the wiring in your house. So if you don't have a lightning rod, you get struck by lightning, your house gets struck by lightning, get into a fully enclosed metal vehicle, get out of the house, call the fire department so that they can come out, make sure that all the wiring is okay, that no fires have started or anything like that. So that's also why a fully, you know, enclosed substantial building is a safe place, because whether you've got a lightning rod on it or you've just got electrical and plumbing in the walls, the electricity is traveling through there and not through you. But you do need to be safe when you're in a house, in a building. Don't stand next to the window. Don't sit on a computer that's plugged into the wall. Don't be playing a video game that's got the controller plugged into the console, plugged into the wall. These are all things that have happened in recent years where somebody in Oklahoma was working at home, lightning struck, it came through their computer, shocked them. Somebody in, I think in the UK, and somebody in Tennessee were playing video games, lightning struck the house or struck right outside, came through the wire and came through the controller and shocked them. People have died on the phone that's been plugged into the wall when lightning came through the telephone wire and entered their body that way. So if there's a thunderstorm, unplug the laptop if you want to keep working on it. Use a handheld controller if you want to play your video games. You just got to be away from where that electricity is. So don't, you know, we don't stick a fork into the outlet. You know, don't be connected to that outlet if there's a thunderstorm nearby.
So it does seem like there is some value to lightning rods. So how much do these cost? And are there certain parts of the country where you think it's worth it based on the amount of lightning that they see to invest in a lightning rod, and maybe other parts of the country that don't see as much lightning, and you can put this as a very, if you have lots of expendable income maybe, but put it as a low priority?
Yeah, you know, the cost of lightning protection can really vary because what these lightning protection vendors do And if you want a reputable lightning protection installer, visit lightning.org. That's the Lightning Protection Institute. They certify lightning protection installers. Now, they look at data like we produced for the How Much Lightning Strikes the United States paper. They're looking at ground strike points and the ground strike point density to make calculations for how much protection does a small building need, how much protection does this big building need, and they make recommendations based on that. So the cost of lightning protection is always custom to what you're trying to protect. And it doesn't just include lightning rods. It could be a surge protector before you get into the house. So where your electric box is, you can put a surge protector out there, surge protector there with the circuit breakers, surge protectors on appliances. So, I mean, it's a multifaceted thing. You get the lightning rods, but then you've got surge protectors and other, you know, fail points to each stop different parts of the lightning electricity from coming in. So if you're really interested, you know, lightning.org, find a reputable contractor from the Lightning Protection Institute. They can work with you on, you know, protecting whatever building you want to protect. Where the lightning density is the highest, that's where you should really consider lightning rods and other lightning protection. So Gulf Coast, Florida, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Arkansas, Missouri. I could rattle off various states like that, but you know, look for the lightning density maps and where the lightning density is the highest. That's a good place to do a first consideration. The other one that I would recommend is churches. Churches get struck by lightning a lot. There's a isolated, tall, pointy thing on most churches, the steeple and the cross. It's pointing up there a couple hundred feet high, and they get struck frequently, whether it's in Massachusetts or the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, Virginia, anywhere around the country, we see a lot of churches that get struck by lightning. So that's another good place to look at investing in lightning protection. And amusement parks, you know, you've got a lot of people there. They're out there just to have fun. They're not paying attention to the weather, but you've got isolated, tall, pointy things called roller coasters. That's a good place to put lightning protection, but also lightning warning systems that use reputable lightning detection data to tell you where the lightning is so that you can set an alert before the lightning gets there. So anywhere that you've got, you know, large crowds, so football stadiums, NFL draft is coming up this weekend, and there's a chance of storms in Detroit. So the Weather Service is going to be looking at weather data and talking with the NFL to make sure that everybody stays safe. So, you know, anywhere you've got a lot of people that maybe aren't paying attention, you want to look into investing in protection and warning systems so that you know where the storms are.
Yeah, I like that. Tall, isolated, and pointy. Those are three things that I hadn't thought to put together in a summary, but I'm quite certain I'm going to be stealing that from you, but I'll do my best to always give you credit. But just to reiterate, you're not safe outside if there's lightning. I mean, there's no magic umbrella that anybody's going to be able to put up that magically pushes the lightning away from a stadium, for example, right?
That's correct. Anywhere outside is a lightning hazard when there's lightning in the area.
All right. Thank you very much. Listen, before we let you go, you've actually moved on from Vaisala and you're now in Madison, Wisconsin. Tell people what you're doing there in Madison.
Yeah. So about a year ago, I moved from the lovely Front Range of Colorado to Cheese Country here in Madison, Wisconsin. And I am leading the development of a mezzanet across the state of Wisconsin. So mezzanet, if you're not familiar, is a statewide network of a very high resolution. So at least one weather station in every county. And we're building one out here in Wisconsin, going to target between 80 and 90 weather stations across the state in the next couple of years.
That's excellent. I think everybody should have that. Of course, it's up to every state to decide how they want to approach that. I don't have a lot of pull, but that's one of those things I would love to have here in Virginia, because we've got coast, we've got a bay, we've got mountains, we got all the good stuff here as well. Chris, where can people find out more about the work you're doing online?
So if you go to National Lightning Safety Council, if you Google that, or lightningsafetycouncil.com, that'll get you to all the work that the National Lightning Safety Council is doing. If you want to see what I'm doing, WiscoNet, WISCONET is the name of our mesonet. And you can follow me on the socials at CO Weatherman. Even though I'm now in Wisconsin, I am keeping the CO Weatherman moniker, just because everybody's known me as that for the last 9 or 10 years now.
All right, Chris, that's all great. Thanks for joining us again. And you know what? I like to do this every year, every time we get toward thunderstorm season. So good luck with everything there in Wisconsin. We will talk with you again soon, man.
All right. Thanks for having me. Have a good one, guys.
Yeah, every time I have a question about lightning, if it's something that I don't know, Chris is the first guy I'm going to go to, because he has so much experience with the lightning detection network, understanding how it works, and obviously understanding the safety, the do's and don'ts, and the things that can trick you about lightning. Some people, you know, as he alluded to, still think, oh, I got rubber shoes on, I'm fine. Nah, man, the kind of voltage coming out of that cloud doesn't care anything about your rubber-soled tennis shoes. But, you know, a lot of this came not just from a new study that he did, but the viewer question, right, Matt?
Yeah, when Joshua sent us that question, which we encourage everyone to do, we've mentioned it before, please send us your weather questions, because not only, it could sometimes be a real quick, easy question that we might be able to answer on our own at the end of an episode, but sometimes, like this one, it actually stumped us, and we didn't have a good answer for him. It's like, what does affect the accuracy of the lightning detection network? Would a body of water actually impact it? So then it's like, you know what, we need to get Chris back on, not just to answer this question for us, but let's just have a follow-up, but answer some more lightning questions. So that question was the inspiration for getting Chris back on and doing a whole episode about lightning. So Joshua, can't thank you enough for sending in that question. And so if you have a weather question or a topic that you'd like to make us turn into a whole episode, send us an email, podcasts@lee.net, podcasts@lee.net, or you can leave us a voicemail. If you want to do it the old-fashioned way, we do have a phone line. You can call, you voicemail that way. The phone number is 609-272-7099, 609-272-7099. So send us your questions.
Yeah, so a lot of good stuff coming up in the next couple of weeks. Next week, we're going to start talking about drought, flash drought. You know, we hear about flash floods. But what is a flash drought? You know, too long, don't read. It's a drought that onsets very quickly. We're going to be getting close to summer by then. Jan Dutton from Prescient Weather will be joining us with the summer outlook and how we do these 4 and 5 month outlooks anyway. And in Memorial Day, the idea of you doing some traveling, Jen Carfagno from the Weather Channel will join us to talk about her traveling road trips everywhere from Punxsutawney Phil to see the groundhog and the party, to these massive snowstorms that they have in the Sierra Nevada Ranch. This reminder, if you enjoy the podcast, please rate and review us. In this day and age, every little bit helps. So review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. We very much appreciate you listening to us. We will be back next week with more. So for Matt Hollander in Chicago, Hannah Nepsinchuk, Kirsten Lang from Tulsa, and Joe Martucci at the Press of Atlantic City, I'm meteorologist Sean Sublett in Richmond. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time on the Across the Sky podcast.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.